It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 WRIR and at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegebright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
That means that a student to the greatest degree possible is going to be educated with his non-disabled peers. And so we want to ensure that every student has the right to access learning and to share that learning with all other students.
Valerie Slater, staff attorney at the Disability Law Center of Virginia, describes the laws that protect children with disabilities against separate and unequal treatment in public education. And during this week's News You Can Use, we ask whether the State Corporation Commission will do something about car title lending, as asked to by the General Assembly. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 288, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR, 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Earlier this year, lawmakers considered a number of bills aimed at cracking down on car title lending, a practice critics say is predatory and traps consumers in a cycle of debt. Members of the General Assembly decided, instead, to ask state regulators to take action. But now, more than 2 months later, leaders at the State Corporation Commission have yet to determine whether they have authority to take action. Governor Terry McAuliffe started the session by asking lawmakers to crack down on the car title lending industry. But after considering more than a dozen bills, lawmakers decided against passing legislation. Instead, they decided to send a letter to regulators asking them to take action. Now, 2 months later, leaders at the State Corporation Commission say they're not sure if they have authority to take action without a change to the law. The letter was from Senate Commerce Committee Chairman Frank Wagner and Senate Minority Leader Dick Sasslaw. It asks regulators to revoke something called dual licenses. That's what allows car title lenders to offer consumer finance loans and allows payday lenders to offer car title loans. Basically, these businesses would have to pick one kind of loan and stick to it, avoiding what many critics say is a bait-and-switch operation. Wagner believes the State Corporation Commission has that authority, saying, "We're going to ask the SCC to monitor it, and I think the industry understands that if it doesn't happen, we'll be back next year with that legislation." But some lawmakers question whether regulators can take action without legislation authorizing them to do so. One thing is for certain, though. By deciding against legislation and opting for the letter instead, lawmakers have cut the governor out of the process. By not passing legislation, the action on car title lending cannot be considered by the governor because it never came across his desk. So, members of the General Assembly can take credit and possibly avoid blame. According to Becky Bowers-Lanier with the Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy, if you give it to a regulator to make the decision, then you don't have to blame yourself for it. So, lawmakers have avoided reforming the car title lending industry. Instead, they'll be waiting for the State Corporation Commission to make a decision about what kind of authority it has. Lawmakers may not be able to avoid a vote forever, however. If regulators decide they can't take action without legislation, the General Assembly is certain to consider another round of bills again next year. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. We're here at the Disability Law Center of Virginia, and we are speaking with Valerie Slater. She is a staff attorney in the Child Advocacy Unit with the Disability Law Center of Virginia, and we will be talking about the rights of persons with disabilities to education services, particularly public education. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
We're glad to have you. And before we get into the topic, would you tell our listening audience what exactly is the Disability Law Center of Virginia?
Okay, so every state is mandated to have a protection and advocacy agency, and the Disability Law Center of Virginia is Virginia's agency for just that purpose. We advocate for the rights of individuals with disabilities all over the state, and we have 9 federal grants that fund our work.
Okay, so we're talking about public education here primarily, and I know that disability has sometimes a different definition depending upon what right is being discussed, whether it's public accommodations or employment or housing. But for the purposes of public education, what is considered a disability?
Well, a disability would be within one of the 13 categories that are outlined in the Americans with Disability Act. But then not only must there be a disability, but it must also impact a child's access to education. And it must be that two-prong test that is met. So there must be an actual disability, and then that disability must impact that child's access to learning in order for them to be defined as a child with a disability.
So what do we mean by access to education?
So when a student is in the learning environment, that disability must prevent them from learning. It must impede their ability to interpret the information that they are receiving. It must in some way prohibit them from gaining the benefit of the educational, the instruction that is being given.
So let's assume we have a student with a disability. They meet that two-pronged test of first having the disability, and secondly, that it impedes their ability to benefit from the learning instruction. What rights does that student with a disability have?
The child needs to first be identified, and that identification can come from the parent, it can come from a teacher, it can come from anyone working with the student. And I mean, and that really does mean anyone. And so once a student is identified, then a request for evaluations is the next step.
And who does that evaluation?
It's incumbent upon the school division to provide all of the evaluations. And they must provide evaluators who are qualified to do the particular evaluations that must happen.
So when the evaluation is made, what's the next step in the process?
So once all of the evaluations have been completed, and evaluations would usually cover psychological evaluation, educational, occupational, physical therapy, speech, language. But once all of that evaluative data has been collected, then an eligibility meeting will be held. At that meeting, the parents and a team is assembled to look at all of the evaluative data, and a decision will then be made as to whether or not this student is eligible for special education services.
So if the decision is made that the student is eligible for special education services, what is the next step in the process after that?
The next step would be, once the child is identified, they will look at the category under which the child is identified, and they will then begin to put together the team that is going to come up with all of the services that will be necessary to provide that particular student with a free and appropriate public education. And that team is called the IEP team, and the IEP stands for Individualized Educational Program.
So Give us an example of the types of services that would be necessary for a student to have a free and appropriate public education.
So let's say we have a student, and this particular student has a specific learning disability, and that disability is in math. And let's just toss in also that perhaps this student has maybe dexterity issues and has trouble holding a pencil, or just perhaps weakness in the hands. This student would need specialized math services. Maybe they would modify the curriculum. The student might need assistive technology, and so that's another evaluation that would be done to determine what would best serve the student to help him have access to the education as it comes to the weakness in the hands. How is that student going to be able to use the different modalities of education? If the student isn't able to hold, say, a pencil or a pen, then perhaps they start looking at keyboarding or other ways that the student would be able to access that learning without being impeded by the weakness in his hands, that particular piece of that disability.
Now, one of the phrases that is a part of the rights of persons with disabilities to a free and appropriate public education is to receive it in what's called the least restrictive environment. Can you tell us what that means?
Least restrictive environment. That means that a student, to the greatest degree possible, is going to be educated with his non-disabled peers. And so we want to ensure that every student has the right to access learning and to share that learning with all other students and not be placed in restrictive environments with strictly only other students with disabilities. Now, that is going to be governed by what level of educational services, first of all, a student is able to access, and then what supports and services can be put into place to ensure that a student remains, at least to some degree, around non-disabled peers. And then also the law looks at how far away is a particular placement from a student's home. And so when you put all of that together, we're going to first of all look and see, where is this student going to get the best education or access to the most appropriate education around his disabled peers, and how far away that is from that student's home. And that is all going to work together to determine what the least restrictive environment looks like.
So how severe an impairment or disability does a student have in order to essentially be not mainstreamed or not educated with the non-disabled peers?
You know, that's an interesting question, in that we can't really define that. What is always going to be most appropriate is that a student receive some access that is greater than de minimis or next to nothing. It's got to be access to education that is meaningful. And so, regardless of the severity of a particular disability, if a student is able to sit and gain benefit from an elective class with non-disabled peers, then that would be appropriate. And so when we begin to attempt to categorize and say that we can't allow this particular student, because of the severity of their disability, to be in a classroom with non-disabled peers, we're looking at every opportunity, and every opportunity means sometimes it may not be the academic components, but perhaps it is electives, and there are other ways to ensure a student receives access.
Now, we mentioned the Individualized Education Program, or IEP. How often does that have to be looked at?
Every year. At the beginning of every year, a student's IEP needs to be evaluated to ensure that it is specifically designed to meet the needs of that student for that particular school year. And then every 3 years is what the law calls the triennial. And the triennial, it happens to ensure that if new evaluative data needs to be collected, it's that opportunity to take a look at the last 3 years and determine what progress has this particular student been making, and do we need to collect new evaluations and to determine whether or not this student is truly making progress.
And what if the parent or caretaker of the student with disabilities believes that that reevaluation is needed sooner than every 3 years? Is there a right to request that reevaluation sooner?
A parent has the right to request an evaluation every year. If they are of the impression that their student is not making progress, if they are of the impression that the IEP is not reasonably calculated to provide their student with educational benefit, then they have a right to request that evaluations be conducted so that a determination can be made based on hard data.
And now you mentioned that the school district itself provides the evaluator or evaluative team. What if the parent doesn't believe in or trust those evaluators? Does the parent have a right to say, no, I want this independent outside evaluator to come in and I want the school to pay for it? Does the parent have that right to ask for that?
Now, once the school has conducted all of their evaluations, yes, the parent has a right to disagree with the evaluations or the findings of those evaluations, not per se with the evaluators themselves. But the parent does have the right to say, I disagree with the findings of these evaluations. I don't feel perhaps that they are an accurate reflection of my student's functioning or functioning levels. And so at that point, the parent does indeed have a right to an independent educational evaluation, and that is at public expense. And the school division must then provide a list of providers in the area, but the parent is not obligated to select one of those providers on the school division's list. But the school division must at least attempt to help the parent by providing a starting point, if you will.
All right, so let's assume there has been this evaluation or the school has come up with it and has come up with a proposed IEP, Individualized Education Program, and the parent or caretaker simply disagrees with it. What rights does the parent or caretaker have at that particular point in time?
Okay, so let's talk about this in two parts. Let's talk about first the initial Individualized Education Program and then a subsequent. So when we're talking about the initial, the very first IEP, if the parent refuses to consent to the provision of services as outlined in that first initial IEP and refuses to work with the school to come up with something that would be workable, then the school division is then no longer obligated to provide educational or individualized education services for that particular student. The agreement to the initial IEP is where the parent is basically agreeing that, yes, my child is a student with disability, yes, my child does need individualized education services, and yes, I am going to consent to the provision of those services. And so the parent has really got to work with the school and get a first or an initial IEP signed so that services can become mandated for their particular student. So now let's say that the student's had an IEP for a while and a triennial has come up or that yearly evaluation has come up and the parent is sitting down at the table and they disagree with something within that IEP. The parents can then, they can raise those concerns, and the school division must work with the parent to either resolve those issues, or the parent can engage the dispute resolution process. But while that process is going on, the student will be served under what is called a stay put IEP, and that stay put IEP will be the last signed IEP by the parent.
And can you lead us through that dispute resolution process? How is that invoked? Who does that? What's involved there?
Okay, so either the school division or the parent has the right to engage the dispute resolution process. And most often it would begin with mediation. So let's say the school division and the parent are unable to reach an agreement as to what would be appropriate services. Then the school division can ask the parent to go to mediation to have an independent mediator try to resolve the issues. The parent also has the right to do the same. Then if at mediation they're unable to reach resolution, and if the parent believes that it is a black letter law violation or a procedural violation, something that is clearly erroneous according to the law, then the parent has a right to file a state complaint. The parent can contact the Office of Dispute Resolution and get a copy of the complaint form and that process, and they would write out what violation they believe the school division has made, what remedies they believe would be most effective, and they would just explain what they believe the school division has done in violation of their or their students' rights. The next level of the dispute resolution process would be due process. Parent would have the right to file for due process, just as the school division also has the right to file. The filing party then bears the burden to prove that the other party has indeed injured them or has violated a right. So if the parent were to file for due process, they would have to explain what it is that the school division has done that has violated their or their student's right. They would have the ability to call witnesses to support the allegation. They would have the ability to produce whatever evidence for an impartial hearing officer to determine whether or not a violation of that student or that parent's right has indeed been made. But the other party has the right to rebut. And so whereas one side would indeed say, this is my case and this is what I believe has happened, the other side would then also have the opportunity to.
And who are these impartial hearing officers who preside at these due process hearings?
The impartial hearing officers are appointed by the Virginia Department of Education, and they are individuals who have been given training to understand the special education process, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and the Virginia regulations that govern special education. And they are appointed by the Department of Education to preside over these cases, and their decisions are binding, but they can be appealed.
And the other topic I wanted to discuss has to do with students who misbehave, and that happens for students without disabilities, that happens students with disabilities. What added responsibilities does a public school have if it wishes to discipline or to suspend or even to expel a student who, in fact, has been identified as having a disability?
There is indeed an added responsibility, but it only kicks in after a student has been suspended for more than 10 days. So if a student with disabilities is being disciplined and it is for 1 day or 2 days, then they're going to be disciplined as a student without a disability. But once that threshold has been met, once we are at 10 days and 1 hour, then the school division must hold what is called a manifestation determination review. A manifestation determination review determines whether or not the student's behavior is caused by their disability, or is the student's behavior an indicator that the school division has failed to appropriately implement that student's IEP. If either of those two standards are met, then the school division must conduct what's called a functional behavioral assessment to determine what is causing the behaviors and how can they best be, how can the student best be supported to learn different behaviors, more appropriate behaviors, or to modify the student's reactions so that the escalated behaviors do not occur. Once the functional behavioral assessment has been conducted, then a team is going to come together and they're going to develop what is called a behavioral intervention plan. And that plan is going to be the roadmap to assist the student in modifying and redirecting behaviors. But it's also going to be holding the school division accountable to ensure that they are indeed providing whatever supports are necessary so that student can be educated in the least restrictive environment and with the supports necessary to continue to have access to education.
And finally, where can people get more information about the rights of students with disabilities to public education?
you are also able to go to the Disability Law Center of Virginia's website. We have a special education online resource where you are able to look up what your particular issue is and just kind of follow the questions and answers to guide you to perhaps what could be very beneficial information that can help you with your particular issue. We also have office hours here at the Disability Law Center of Virginia every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday between the hours of 8:30 and 4 p.m. You're able to call in and ask to speak to the advocate on duty, and that individual will be able to listen to the issues that you're facing and provide you perhaps with information and referral that will help you understand the issue or some other level of service.
And could you give us the website for the Disability Law Center of Virginia?
That is dlcv.org.
Well, thank you very much. We have been speaking with Valerie Slater. She is a staff attorney with the Child Advocacy Unit at the Disability Law Center of Virginia. And we have been speaking about the rights of students with disabilities to receive a free and appropriate public education in the least restrictive environment. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. It is impossible to consider poverty in America without tackling the central role of housing. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when we broadcast a special presentation by Associate Professor Matthew Desmond on his New York Times best-selling book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegmeyer.